Good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Rebecca Mackay, whose novel, The Great Believers, was published on June 19th. It's a novel of great scope, which nonetheless manages to be achingly intimate. I feel like I've known Rebecca for several years because her novel, The 100-Year House, was the first I ever wrote a blurb for, and we've been connected on social media ever since, but this is our first real conversation. Rebecca, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm glad to actually get to talk to you. I've thanked you in writing for blurbing that book, but now I can thank you out loud. So thank you.
The Great Believers is a novel about family, about art, about loneliness, and about the height of the AIDS epidemic in Chicago in the 1980s. For those of us who lived through those years and lost friends to that horrible disease, it's really an emotional read, but I think a beautifully crafted novel.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with beginnings. And in your first chapter, you have a very pointed reference to Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Red Death. Can you remind us about that story and tell us why you chose to reference it so early in your novel?
Yeah, it's the Mask of the Red Death is that story where it's a, I can't remember if it's a nobleman or a duke, I'm going to get the details wrong on this a little bit, who is having a party and has kind of enclosed everyone in a room because there is a plague out there. And he knows that, you know, it's dangerous out there, but they've all locked themselves in. There's food, there's wine, everything's great. And then they realize that actually the plague is among them. And, you know, it's actually one of my favorite Poe stories. It's just incredibly unsettling. And someone's, you know, joking about it early on in a sort of gallows humor type way. Actually really gets the story wrong in his joke and says, this is great. Death is out there, but we're in here having fun. It's like that story. And my main character's going, that story doesn't end well. Don't you remember?
Right.
You know, my book certainly doesn't exactly follow the course of that story, but it is very much about a plague. It's very much about, you know, gathering your friends close, trying to, you know, keep living your life when this force, it just keeps encroaching and you can't lock it out. There's nothing you can do to be safe from it.
Right. My wife and I are both in our mid-50s. I say that, you know, being kind to us using the word mid. But if you do the math, you'll figure out that we were young adults in the mid-1980s. We both lost friends in the AIDS crisis. And I'm wondering if you had that experience at all in your life as well.
Well, not at that point in time. I'll put my age right out there. I was born in 1978. So I was a kid when this was all going on. I was very aware for a kid. You know, I think I have, you know, many memories of the AIDS stuff coming on the news. And that was the thing that I would stop and actually listen to on the news. I wasn't interested in anything else, you know, Oliver North or whatever, you know, had zero right. interest. They mentioned AIDS and my ears perked up and I wanted to know everything about this, and about this population that was being affected and about, all the fear. And it felt to me as a child as important as it was, which is to say, you know, it was one of the major events in America of the 20th century. That said, no, I was young. I did not have at that point, friends who were HIV positive or lose anyone close to me. Certainly as an adult, I do have friends who are HIV positive and I have, you know, as you know, someone who works in the arts in a major city, have just a wonderfully inordinate number of gay friends. So much of my connection to that time was just visceral. I was a kid of the AIDS era in the same way that my mother was a kid of the Depression and of World War II. She grew up with those things, you know, in the background, affecting her only tangentially, but it has forever changed her thinking, her way of relating to the world. And I think there was a whole generation there, right around my age who very much grew up with this being the thing in the background. And kids are porous, you know, kids absorb that. So I say that, you know, kind of to explain why it was important to me personally and why I very much wanted to write about this. But I'm also saying, you know, I had no right to write about this. This is not my story to tell. And I was, had a tremendous amount of concern and consideration of that going into this, that I didn't, not only am I writing across difference, I'm a straight woman, I'm writing in, you know, not entirely, but largely about gay men, but also that I didn't have that personal story. I didn't lose a brother or something like that. You know, so that obviously is an issue I made my peace with, or I wouldn't be publishing this book.
Sure.
But it was very much on my mind as I wrote.
It fascinates me to hear you talk about how it affected your generation, because I know how it affected my generation, where we were, I mean, I was a straight man, but I was a theater major in college. I had lots of gay friends, and sure. And you know, again, my wife and I both had close friends that we lost. But then there was my daughter's generation, and my daughter is a member of the LGBT community, and you know, she asked me, what was it like? Because to her, it was a story from the musical Rent, you know.
Right.
And so it's been very interesting for me to see how the height of that crisis, knowing that it's not over, but the height of that crisis has sort of echoed out amongst different generations and how it affected different generations.
Yeah, I think there's certainly, it's you know, been a really interesting crash course the past few weeks for me in generational differences, as I've talked about this book, as some of the people who've interviewed me are younger than I am. And, you know, their questions are, or they're just their observations about what they learned as they read the book were, kind of startling to me, things for me to realize the things they hadn't known. There's tremendous interest in it out there among that younger generation. I think, you know, it's a generation, you know, millennials and younger, they are very aware. They're very, you know, they want to know this stuff, but of course we don't talk about it enough. And while there is some absolutely wonderful art out there about the AIDS epidemic, I would argue that there's not nearly enough, either in fiction or in nonfiction, that we should be talking about this epidemic to the same extent that we talk about, study, create art about World War One.
Sure.
And for the same reasons, you know, so that it doesn't happen again, and so that we can understand America as it is and as it was, and just to remember.
I think you're right. It's definitely a story that needs to be told. So tell us the story. Tell us the basic setup of The Great Believers.
Yeah. So my main character, for most of the book, is a man named Yale Tishman. He's in his early 30s. He lives in Chicago. He's the development director for a small art gallery at Northwestern University. And the book starts with a memorial service for his first close friend to die of AIDS. He and his friends are at a memorial because they weren't invited to the actual funeral. So they're having this party elsewhere. And the book follows him over the next 7 years as his life does unravel, as the disease comes closer and closer to him. But as his life also takes on much greater meaning. And, you know, in many ways, a coming of age story for him, even as things get bleaker and bleaker. Meanwhile, every other chapter is in contemporary Paris, or rather 2015 Paris, which doesn't feel that contemporary to me anymore. So it just happened since 2015. It was contemporary when I was writing it, though, where this woman named Fiona, it was her brother who died, whose funeral was going on at the beginning of the book. She has traveled. She's now in her 50s. And she's traveled to Paris to track down her estranged daughter. And because of some of the circumstances of who she meets up with in Paris, some people from back in the day, some other events in her life, she's really forced to revisit and finally come to terms with a lot of the events that she went through 30 years earlier in caring for this group of men.
Would you read us an excerpt from the book?
I would, absolutely. I think actually, since I was just talking about Fiona, maybe I'll read you something of hers. So this is a short section. And what I'll say here is that when she's in Paris, she's staying with a guy named Richard Campo, who When we first met him in the 80s, he was just sort of an amateur photographer, or everyone considered him an amateur photographer. He's always sort of lurking on the edge of this group of friends taking photos. When we're in 2015, though, we learned that he has become very, very famous as a photographer. He's about to have a career retrospective in Paris, and is famous in large part for his documentation of the AIDS crisis. On his shelf in his apartment, where Fiona is now alone, are a lot of old photo albums that he was looking through with her earlier. And they just have his snapshots from back in the 80s, so very different than his artistic work. And she's finally ready to look through those on her own. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them up. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw, when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater. Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terrence Robinson, Nico's Terrence. How odd. She must have put this bulletin together herself, but she didn't remember it. Jonathan Bird, Dwight Summer. There were so many of them, so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store. She works, I'm going to break here to say she works at a resale shop that benefits AIDS housing. Someone would wander into the store, and then when they discovered its mission, say something like, "Oh, I remember that time." Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. "I knew someone whose cousin had it," they'd continue. "Did you ever see Philadelphia?" And they'd shake their heads in dismay. And how could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard? That they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust, a mass murder of neglect and antipathy. That when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here in her hand, a stack of ghosts.
Just beautiful. You're a heterosexual woman, as you said, and yet I think you found a way to write about a crisis that struck most brutally at the homosexual male community. How did you make the AIDS crisis not just a tragedy of one group, but all of our tragedy?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that the universal is in the specific, right? And I think that a mistake, and that's not, it wouldn't have been a mistake. I think it might have been tempting to try to portray this entire epidemic and show, for instance, many different demographics that it hit and how those demographics changed over time, and to have, characters in the 1990s who were, stricken with it in the heterosexual community, who were, or who were drug users. That broad of a story didn't feel like it was going to work for me. I needed to tell a specific story about a specific group of friends, knowing that that is more likely to appeal to people's sense of compassion and to their, into the universality of the story. When you know that one person's face, I think that's better than seeing a mob, right? So, I think it was a lot of that, and it was a lot of, making sure that I did the research to be able to tell this story, not only empathetically, but accurately. And I think that actually that accuracy helped me, helped the empathy, helped the realism, helped the scope of it in so many ways. Being able to get those details right because of all the people who helped me write this book.
As a child of the 60s and 70s, I was really struck by something that Yale says early on in the book. I think it's about the third chapter. He's trying to figure out what's happened to all of his friends, and he worries about, and here I'm quoting, news from Russia, something so alarming they had run home and made preparations. Growing up, for me, nuclear war was quite honestly the crisis that we expected, and AIDS was the crisis we got.
Yeah.
Do you see thematic parallels between the two?
Between nuclear war and AIDS?
Yeah.
I mean, I think you just put it really well. I think that, you know, first of all, you know, there were some similarities. They were both big looming fears. They were both crises that American policy got us into in many ways. But in both cases, they were in many ways about men in politics trying to prove their own strength, you know, trying to prove their own, you know, quote unquote manliness, in the one case by escalating an arms race, and in the other case by refusing to acknowledge a disease that was seen as belonging to the gay community. So there's that. But I think what you just said about, you know, we expected the one and we got the other. I think that that distinction is really important, that people were, you know, in the 80s, it was a time of a lot of fear, you know, fear about nuclear war, also fear about, if you remember in the 80s, all the fear about child abductions and Satanism and all these things that seem to have been, you know, coming from some weird place in the collective subconscious, because they weren't actually really any more issues then than any other era, right? The thing, you know, the ball we should have had our eye on was this disease and how to stop it and how to educate people about it. And instead of being vigilant, people were, on the whole, reactive and reacting out of fear and reacting out of blame. You know, I think there's that, you know, they talk, and I think it's called the just world theory or the just universe theory. I never quite remember what it is. The psychological phenomenon that when we see injustice, if we can't immediately fix it, we have this sort of knee-jerk instinctive reaction to try to tell ourselves that actually the world is just. And the person who just, you know, got injured, the person who just died or whatever it is, must have brought it on themselves in some way. It's this thing that we do, I think, to protect ourselves. You know, that won't happen to me because actually the world's fair. I'm doing the right thing, so it won't happen to me. And so I, you know, psychologically you can understand where some of that stuff is coming from, but there was a lot of hatred behind it as well. There was a lot of it's happening to those people over there, so we don't need to worry about it. And, you know, it was, you know, AIDS has killed 35 million people. It continues to kill 1 million people a year, largely in Africa. And now we have the issue that in America, there's, you know, less attention on that for, you know, not for homophobic reasons necessarily anymore, but I think racism comes into it and distance and lack of awareness. You know, those, we tend to be afraid of the big, dramatic, cataclysmic thing that goes boom, you know, and not as afraid of what we might manage to do to ourselves as a community, as a country through neglect. AIDS was in many ways a genocide that we let happen through neglect. And it's really interesting looking back and saying, you know, we were so scared of this one thing, and the one thing we could have done something about, we could have handled AIDS better. Regular citizens couldn't have done much about nuclear war. We could have done so much more about AIDS than we did. And you know, the reaction on the whole was some combination of fear and dismissal instead.
You depict in the novel, in the Chicago part of the novel, not just gay culture, but this very specific gay community of 1980s Chicago, a particular neighborhood, a particular set of people. How do you, especially looking back on it from the past and knowing that you're going to have, as you said, readers who don't remember that time, how do you depict that culture without the danger of falling into a stereotype?
Right. You know, that was an interesting subset of my concerns in writing Across Difference, that, you know, sometimes the same detail that might come across as genuine coming from someone within that community could seem stereotypical coming from someone outside of it, even if I've done my research, even if I know that that was the case. So an example that I've been using, I was writing about this one really wonderful AIDS unit in Chicago at Illinois Masonic Hospital. It was, I believe, the first dedicated AIDS unit in the country and then became a model of compassionate AIDS care around the world. And I interviewed many different people who had either worked there or been patients there or had friends there. And one of the details that kept coming up was that there were Broadway posters all over the walls. And I love this so much. I have to include it, right? And I'm writing about a real, very real place. I'm including very real details. I'm not going to leave out the one thing everyone talks about. But coming from me as an outsider, if someone imagines that I made that up, it's going to seem like the stupidest cliche, right? Like I just, you know, I couldn't think of another thing, so I put Broadway posters on the walls. So, you know, I had to work really hard on that section to make sure I introduced it in just the right way with a little bit of self-awareness, that I included so many other details as well that I'd come across in my research of this one unit, so that it didn't read as stereotypical. So there was that level of thinking. And then on the character level, you know, I think some of the things that helped me early on, I chose 1985 as a starting point, kind of randomly at the beginning. I just felt like we're a few years into the crisis. Let's see what's happening in 1985. And as I started to research, learned that that was the year the test came out. And then, you know, something that I had not been as aware of, learned about the really varied reactions to the test within the gay community. It's easy to look back and say, yes, everyone needs to know their status. At the time, there was a tremendous amount of fear around the testing. First of all, you know, is it even accurate? Secondly, do I want to know? And what good is it going to do me if there's no medication, even ameliorative medication? There's nothing at this point in 85. Right. And then thirdly, what if these results are somehow subpoenaed or co-opted by the government? What if, you know, what if the offices of the doctor are raided? So as I'm looking back, and I did a lot of reading back issues, archived issues of gay weeklies from the late 80s, which was actually really fun, you know, occasionally incredibly depressing, but there was always, you know, a sense of joy they're always showing where the party is at the same time that they're talking about, you know, the crisis. So you're reading an op-ed about, condoms, and then, you know, beside it is, you know, here are photos from the Halloween party at this bar, and it was lovely. But seeing the different op-eds going on in 85 about testing, and then the letters to the editor, and then just, you know, all these incredibly nuanced and varied points of view, that helped me build my characters. I was starting to write about my cast of characters, and I'm thinking, okay, let me think through each different person's reaction to this. No two people are going to think about it in exactly the same way. What are their reactions going to be? And that, you know, getting into issues like that, and that's just one example, where you're seeing variance within the community, you know, you're seeing disagreement, you're seeing, you know, extremes of human behavior as you would in any community. That helped me differentiate my characters very early, which of course is one of the best ways to write against stereotype, is to simply provide many different examples, none of which are the same. Right.
I was in college in the early 1980s, and it was a time when being out was just a lot harder than it is now, especially at a small Southern college, liberal though we may have been. And my roommate was, I would have described him as sort of slightly out, but he was a gay man, and he worked at a bar in the nearby big city on the weekends. And you talk a lot about the bar culture, or you depict the bar culture some in your novel. And I gradually came to realize that for him, it was the one place where he could really be himself.
Right.
And I wondered how, you know, how do we as, you know, straight white people who can sort of go anywhere and be ourselves, how do we grab a hold of that idea that in this particular culture, at this particular time, that their freedom of self-expression was so limited?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that came home for me in the writing even more than I'd already been aware of through the details. One early detail, you mentioned a scene where Yale is, you know, walking around looking for his friends. And when I first wrote that scene, very naively, I had him walking down the sidewalk on Halsted, which is kind of the main drag there for gay bars, looking in the windows of the gay bars he passed to try to find his friends, which is not a thing that you could have done in 1985. The windows would have been blacked out or curtained or obscured in some other way. And that was one of those things that just, you know, if I'd stopped and thought about it, I would have gone, oh my God, of course. But I, you know, I just casually say he's looking in the windows, just didn't hit home for me until I was, you know, interviewing a friend and he was, you know, describing the bar scene and talked about the different ways windows were obscured. Completely eye-opening for me. And so I think that for me, that awareness was, I was, you know, to whatever extent I was aware, I was made so much more aware through research of what was actually, you know, what the stakes were and the little million things you do every day to protect yourself. And I would hope that someone reading the book who hasn't, you know, either just because they're young or because they haven't spent much time in LGBTQ spaces isn't aware of all those little things, that they might pick up on some of those from my novel. One of my favorite ones, I wanted to research whether there had been any gay bar in Ann Arbor, Michigan in the 1970s, because Yale went to college at University of Michigan. And so I looked online and there was this wonderful online account, just someone's memories of this, of the one and only gay bar in Ann Arbor in the 70s, and how what they'd done is they'd hung all these geraniums in the windows, but they were always apparently, you know, half dead. And so the windows, it's just this very depressing, dark place with the windows just full of dead geraniums, which it's just heartbreaking. And I, of course, I had to put it in the novel. But yeah, those, you know, it's, you know, different, but, you know, women are always talking a lot about, you know, men don't understand the 500 things you do every day to keep yourself safe as you unlock your car, right, as you, you know, walk down the hallway of a hotel. Different situation, but that, you know, that awareness of, you know, you don't think about the things that you don't have to think about.
My readers will know that I'm a big fan of stories that are told in multiple time periods, and I have very specific reasons for writing my novels in multiple time periods. But I'm curious to hear your reasons, because you, as you said, you're partly in the mid 1980s, and then you're partly in 2015 in Paris. So what are you trying to accomplish by that juxtaposition of timeline?
Yeah, I love playing with time. For one thing, I think it helps us with dramatic irony. Right? It puts the reader in a unique position where we can know more than any one character. And that's fun, I think, for a reader. It's fun as a writer. Even when it's about something, you know, horrible, you know, you're writing, people are aboard the Titanic and they're having the time of their lives, you know, there's something kind of goosebumpy for me as a writer about, being in that position of knowing more than the characters. And so, you know, when we're in 2015 in this book, we're learning a lot about what has happened to the cast from 1985. And then we're going back there and seeing, you know, the beginnings of that, things that they don't know yet. This person, you know, who might have been diagnosed, but doesn't know that he's going to survive. And we know it. So I like that, you know, the way that it lets you play with dramatic irony without, you know, kind of having to make your characters dim in some way, which is often the way dramatic irony has to be done. I also just love that texture. I love writing about multiple time periods where, for instance, we can meet characters at different points in their lives. or we can visit the same place, but at different times in history. It's something that I love to think about just in my daily life. My brain works that way. At a certain point late in the novel, Fiona is thinking about how the two things she's constantly doing mentally, one is she'll walk around in the modern day and try to picture Boys Town exactly as it was in the 1980s. And she starts by trying to picture brown cars in the street. And if she can picture brown cars, she can get the rest of it. And that the other thing she does is she imagines her brother, Nico, who died in 85, walking beside her and her trying to explain the modern world to him and walking through an airport with him and trying to explain, you know, and it's something about him asking her why everyone's staring at their calculators. My brain works that way. Any place that I'm in, if it's even vaguely historical, I'm obsessed with trying to figure out what already happened there in the past. Any place I go on book tour or on a trip, as soon as I get there, I'm the person like opening the little like folder in the hotel room that tells you the history of the hotel. And I'm looking on Wikipedia to find the history of the place. So it's just, you know, something that I'm personally obsessed with and that I just, it's where I get my writer goosebumps, I think.
I love that scene with Nico, imagining with being with Nico in the airport. Cause to me, it's like, it's the inverse of the scenes where you're taking your readers back into the past and trying to explain the past to them. And here you are trying to explain the future to a character. And I love some of what you said about research. I'm working on a novel right now that has a gay character, although he wouldn't have used the word gay because he's born in 1882 and the novel's set in sort of the early part of the 20th century. And it's very difficult to research because when you're a marginalized community, you don't leave behind the kind of documents that the mainstream community leaves behind. One of the details that you sort of tease out as you're showing the way this disease is starting to move through larger communities is what Charlie calls the commuter gays, and this sort of hypocrisy of these married men who will, you know, come down and cruise the bars once in a while, or as they said in 1906, go slumming is what they called it, and then tell their wives that they're dying of cancer when they end up having AIDS. And that, of course, immediately reminded me of the Roy Cohn character in Angels in America. Yeah. And with this wonderful new production from the National Theater running in New York, I have to ask, have you seen the play? Did the play have an effect on you as a writer or just in the way that you think about the crisis?
Oh, yeah. So I was so fortunate in graduate school to get to study with Oscar Eustace, who was the original, you know, director, producer of that show and really developed it with Tony Kushner. It was be hard to explain my graduate school. I have a master's in literature from Middlebury College, and I'll just say that it's an unusual program. They have a resident every summer, a resident group of actors, like a resident theater troupe comes in. And the summer that I studied with Oscar Eustace, it was 1999. And a lot of the original cast of Angels in America from Provincetown Rep was there in residence, including Ellen McLaughlin, who was the original Angel, and a bunch of others. And so I'm taking this contemporary American theater course with Oscar, and he just brings in the original cast of Angels in America to work with us. it was a huge influence. I'll start by saying that. I adore that play, those plays, however you want to think about it. And I have not been lucky enough to see this new version in New York. I'm dying to. But not only the play itself, but actually my conversations, or I shouldn't say conversations, he was talking to all of us, but what I heard Oscar used to say about the development of that play and about other plays he had worked on and just his take on, you know, Eugene O'Neill or whatever, taught me more about writing than I think any writing class I've ever taken. This man is a national treasure, and he proudly does not even have a college degree, and he's, you know, the best grad school professor I had. His influence on my thinking about plot were one thing, but the play itself, of course, was another. It's a play I know very well and have seen several times and read several times I think another similarity between them is that that play opens with a funeral, not of someone who's died of AIDS. It's an elderly woman. But I started mine with this memorial service, and that was not necessarily an homage, but I kind of did it, realized I was doing it, and thought, eh, it's okay. I'll just keep it. I'm trying to learn from someone who did this masterfully. It doesn't hurt to steal a few tricks. Roy Cohn is a character. I mean, what an amazing character.
Yeah.
My favorite Roy Cohn that I've seen was in Chicago, actually, at the Court Theater. They did a revival, and just this amazing, this guy, Larry Yando, who's, I don't even know why I'm saying his name, but just if you ever see theater in Chicago, go see someone with this guy in it. He is Roy Cohn to me now, in the best way. I don't think I'd throw a drink in his face if I saw him in a restaurant, which I would do to the actual Roy Cohn. But that type of character, that person who, because of the pressures of society, was maybe, you know, living a very closeted, self-loathing kind of life, not being honest with themselves, let alone with romantic partners, sexual partners, you know, spouses, whatever, that didn't help anything. And you look at, you know, things went better with the AIDS crisis in Paris and in London than they went in America.
Yeah.
And so much of that, I really believe, is the reason they were able to get people tested sooner, the reason they were able to get education out there sooner. A lot of it was, you know, public policy. A lot of it was culture. A lot of it was the fact that they didn't have this history of sort of, you know, puritanical self-loathing and repression. They didn't have people like Jesse Helms telling them it was their fault and then internalizing that. And, you know, when you do that to people, bad things result.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually did have the chance to see the original production of Angels on Broadway. I was in New York for a day, and I saw both parts in the same day. I actually walked down the sidewalk behind F. Murray Abraham when he was on his way back to the theater for the evening performance. And you know, I had been going to Broadway shows for several years at that point. And, you know, I'd seen Torch Song Trilogy when it first came out and La Cage aux Folles and all these things were sort of, it felt like the idea of the gay community was beginning to enter the, if you can call Broadway mainstream, the mainstream. But boy, we hadn't seen anything like Angels. It just absolutely blew me away. I still get chills when I think about that production.
I think that it was really one of the first things to look unflinchingly at the gore of the disease.
Yeah, it really did.
I think so much of what had happened before then, it might have been really politically direct, you know, something like The Normal Heart. There was some beautiful theater being done. I also think about Jeffrey, which is a beautiful play. But in terms of really putting it out there, anatomical stuff, but bodily fluids, and depicting, not looking away, you know, I you're not going to have an Angels in America, the sort of, we only know someone has died because someone comes to visit him and, oh, his hospital bed is empty and we didn't see it happen.
Right.
It's going to happen in our faces. And, I love that about what Kushner had done.
Well, there's so much else that we could talk about with this novel. I feel like we could talk all day long about. We've talked a lot about the gay community. We could talk about art. We could talk about Paris. We could talk about how Chicago is so important in your works. I could remind my listeners that if you liked what we were saying about playing around with time, after you read The Great Believers, you've got to go read The 100-Year House, because Rebecca does some really cool stuff with time in that book. But speaking of time, we're just about out of it. So we do like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each of them in just a few words, but hopefully they'll give us some insight and some things to think about writing and also about Rebecca Mackay. So if you're ready, we will begin the speed round.
Think so.
What word do you love to work into your writing?
Apparently the word detritus, which I didn't realize was conscious until I put together my story collection and it was in like 5 different stories.
I love that word. What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
nonplussed because no one knows how to use it right. They always use it to mean the exact opposite of what it means. It drives me nuts.
Yep, yep. Where is your favorite place to write?
Gosh, probably Ragdale, which is an artist's residency north of Chicago. It's just wonderfully old and haunted, and it's got really good vibes.
Where could you never write?
My office, sadly.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I don't know that it's a rule. I'm always saying a couple things, like instead of a couple of things, I'll say a couple things, a couple people, a couple beds, whatever. And I don't really care. Oh, the other one is that I ignore like versus as if. Mm-hmm. I'll say like he walked down the street like he was mad. Not he walked on the street as if he were mad, and you're supposed to do it, you know, sometimes supposed to be like, and so I just don't care.
What was the first book you remember reading?
A nursery rhyme book from which I taught myself how to read when I was little. I sat there, my mom was trying to keep me from reading until I got to school, and I had memorized all the nursery rhymes. So I sat there and moved my finger down and deciphered them all and taught myself how to read.
Oh, wow. What are you reading now?
I am reading an amazing nonfiction book by my friend Kim Brooks. It's called Small Animals, Parenthood in the Age of Fear. And it's this amazing mix between sort of sociological meditation and memoir about the time she got arrested for leaving her son in the car for 5 minutes in perfectly normal weather. And it's just absolutely hilarious and important and beautiful.
What book would you like to have written?
Oh gosh, let's just go with The Great Gatsby. It's just kind of perfect.
What sort of book would you like to write, but probably never will?
You know what? I wish I were a playwright. I don't know if that counts. I've wanted to be one. I forgot to do it. Whoops.
This has been Inside the Writer Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Rebecca Mackay, whose new novel, The Great Believers, is available wherever books are sold. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Next time on Inside the Writer's Studio, I'll be shifting gears to talk with Chris Nashawaty, author of Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.